Using my GI Bill taught me I can do anything. And seeing me graduate taught my daughter she can too. VA benefits cover tuition, housing, and supplies. Get what you earned. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for the type or amount of benefits mentioned here.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today we're tackling, well, what feels like the single most unavoidable question in every market conversation right now.
I know exactly the one.
Is this AI revolution just the next great tech bubble?
It's the defining question, isn't it? And, you know, it's good that people are asking it. We need that critical lens.
It makes me think of that Mark Twain quote we always come back to.
History does not repeat itself, but it often rhymes. It's perfect for this.
Exactly.
So our mission today isn't to, you know, look into a crystal ball and say yes or no. Instead, we're going to use the structural arcs of past cycles.
Like the dot-com boom.
The dot-com explosion, the Web3 frenzy, even going way back to things like the radio craze in the 1920s. We're using them to figure out what fundamentals actually survive the correction that always comes.
So, John, if it's a bubble, but what's being built that's durable?
That's it. We're looking for the durable value that gets built inside all that chaos.
And when you look at all those cycles, there's a pattern that is just, it's so consistent.
It always starts the same way, a genuine, massive technological breakthrough.
Right. With the internet, it was instant communication, global distribution.
With Web3, it was all about decentralized trust, programmable value. And now with AI, it's something different again. It's measurable, human-level reasoning, massive productivity gains.
And that breakthrough is the spark.
It's the spark that opens the floodgates. It ignites this incredible optimism, which fuels speculation, which then pulls in just torrents of capital.
Which leads to excess.
Always.
Yeah.
And eventually, a necessary correction. That correction just wipes out all the undifferentiated stuff, the speculation.
It leaves something behind.
It leaves behind a consolidated landscape where the survivors finally get to build the future that the boom only promised.
Okay, so to really anchor this, let's talk scale. I think we have to start with the granddaddy of them all, the dot-com era. What was the magnitude of that crash?
The magnitude was, well, it's honestly staggering to look back on. The NASDAQ multiplied 6 times in just 5 years, from 95 to 2000.
6 times?
And then it just, the air rushed out. It plunged roughly 77%.
Wow.
And venture investment, it wasn't just high. It was completely untethered. It went up by nearly 20,000% in 5 years.
20,000. It sounds like pure madness now, but you have to remember the atmosphere back then.
Oh, absolutely.
Everyone was convinced that everything was moving online immediately.
Yeah.
And they weren't wrong, just, you know, ridiculously early.
Exactly. I mean, look at pets.com. It became the poster child, the mascot for all that misplaced confidence.
They had the Super Bowl ad, the sock puppet.
They raised hundreds of millions, bought those ads, and just burned through it all in months trying to build logistics that, well, that didn't exist yet.
So they were trying to build the infrastructure themselves.
They embodied the idea that distribution alone was enough, you know, regardless of the actual unit economics.
And yet, here's the paradox. Despite that catastrophic financial collapse, despite pets.com just vaporizing,
the long-term prediction was right.
The prediction that the internet would reshape the world was absolutely spot on.
Oh.
The survivors, your Amazons, your eBays, they were building the things that define the next 2 decades.
So what collapsed was the timeline and the valuations, not the underlying tech trajectory.
That's the crucial lesson, isn't it?
It is. The future was simultaneously overestimated in the short term and severely, severely underestimated in the long term. And we saw that same rhythm with Web3, just a lot faster.
Right. VC funding there topped, what, $30 billion in 2021 alone?
It did. And, you know, Web3 is a good bridge here because the underlying innovation was real. Things like decentralized verification, programmable value.
That's real tech with real use cases.
For sure, especially in emerging markets. But when the cheap money disappeared, most of the application layers, you know, your speculative NFT projects, the DeFi protocols with no regulatory path.
They collapsed.
They collapsed because they just lacked a defensible use case and the value concentrated in the infrastructure.
The beast chains, the core protocols.
Exactly. The settlement layers. And that's where the quiet building continues today. It just proves that infrastructure wins even when most of the apps fail.
Okay, so AI follows that same arc. Boom to consolidation. The critical question then is, how is this boom structurally different? Because the speed is unprecedented and the macro environment is nothing like 1999 or 2021.
Right. And this is where we've sort of distilled 4 key lessons from all the research. And lesson 1 is maybe the most profound.
Which is?
The liquidity pathways have completely reshaped this boom. It's fundamentally changed where the risk actually lands. We call it risk migration.
Okay, explain that. What was the context back in the dot-com days?
Well, back then, federal funds rates were pretty stable, around 5-6%. And crucially, getting to the public markets was incredibly easy.
So you could IPO really quickly.
You could have thin revenue, high burn rate, and still go public. So when the crash came, the losses fell heavily on the public, you know, pension funds, mutual funds, everyday retail investors.
But that is not the world we live in now. Post-COVID, rates are back up over 5%, and the IPO window is, well, it's tiny. The standards are way higher.
Exactly. And what's so fascinating is that the speculation, it hasn't vanished. It just moved upstream.
What do you mean by upstream?
Because it's so hard to exit with an IPO, companies stay private for much, much longer. They raise these huge rounds from late stage private capital.
So large institutions, sovereign wealth funds.
Sophisticated VCs, exactly. They are now the ones absorbing the speculation and the valuation risk that the public markets used to carry.
So the risk hasn't gone away. It's just concentrated among these, you know, cautious institutional investors who are way more sensitive to interest rates.
And that leads directly into lesson two, which is all about visibility and discipline.
Okay.
If companies are staying private longer, they don't have that same immediate pressure for public disclosure that drove the dot-com crash.
Right. In 99, you had to report quarterly, the numbers didn't add up, and the market reacted swiftly.
And brutally. But if today's AI companies can operate privately for 5, 7, maybe even 10 years, that changes the cycle.
How so?
Well, it allows the gap between the narrative, you know, the sci-fi promise of AGI, and the actual performance, the real quarterly revenue. It allows that gap to get much, much wider.
So reality gets delayed.
It does, which means the correction, when it finally comes, is likely to be slower. It won't be a single NASDAQ plunge. It'll be a drawn-out, painful contraction as funding rounds just dry up.
Valuation silently resetting behind closed doors.
Exactly. But slower doesn't necessarily mean smaller in magnitude.
That makes total sense. Public markets enforce discipline. Private markets allow for delayed self-deception.
Well said. So that brings us to lesson three. Infrastructure captures durable value. This is true in every single cycle.
Web 1.0 winners built the rails.
Mm.
Search engines, e-commerce platforms, payment systems.
Web 3 winners built the base chains.
What are the new rails in the AI era? Is it just compute?
It's compute, but it's more nuanced than that. The durable rails, you know, the real value, is in four core assets.
Okay, what are they?
First, compute, GPUs, specialized hardware. Second, the foundational models themselves. Third, and this is key, proprietary data sets. And fourth, distribution power, access to billions of users.
And the application layer, all the cool AI tools we see popping up every day, that seems like the least defensible spot to be right now.
It is. I mean, applications are multiplying like crazy, but without a deep moat in data or distribution, they're often just a thin veneer on top of a foundational model that everyone else can access to.
So there will be winners in the application space, but...
But the infrastructure players, the ones building the models, mining the data, making the chips, they are structurally positioned to capture the largest and most durable share of the value this time around.
Which takes us to lesson four, which, as you said, feels like the most human one. The impact of these bubbles is just highly uneven.
It is. They are cruel meritocracies. At the investor level, early stage folks get a lot of optionality, but they can't escape macro risks, like a global change in interest rates.
And the late stage guys.
The late stage investors, again, because of that narrow IPO window, they're forced to absorb tremendous valuation risk. They're buying in at the top with very few ways to get out.
And on the company level, that unevenness is just brutal.
Oh, it is. The thin application layers, the ones relying on easily copied models, they falter first. Capital just vanishes for them.
But the infrastructure players?
The infrastructure players and the truly enduring applications, they often thrive during the correction. Their weaker competition disappears, and they can scoop up market share and talent for cheap.
So this all really boils down to one thing for anyone building or investing in this space.
Stop obsessing over if it's a bubble.
And start focusing on who is building something that can survive any market condition.
Precisely. Which is a perfect pivot to the four traits that consistently separated the winners from the losers in every past correction. These are the things you have to look for.
Okay, trait number one. It's foundational, but surprisingly easy to forget when money is free. You have to solve an urgent and essential problem.
It has to be grounded in a real desperate need, not just novelty. We use that old filter. Does this business make money, save money, or keep the client out of jail?
If the AI tool doesn't clearly, measurably do one of those three things,
it's a feature, not a business. The durable winners are the ones that become indispensable, even when budgets get tight.
All right, trait two. This is where the AI specificity really kicks in. Unit economics have to get better with scale.
And this isn't just about general efficiency. This is about the underlying cost curve of the tech itself. You've hit on the key challenge.
The compute costs.
For application companies, those initial compute costs can be just staggering, especially for complex generative AI. So real durability requires algorithmic efficiency.
So you're talking about breakthroughs that actually reduce the cost per inference, the cost to process each token.
Yes. As you scale up your users, that cost has to go down. If your gross margins don't improve dramatically because your model costs stay high, you're just relying on a perpetual subsidy.
A subsidy that disappears the second the market turns.
Instantly. Which leads us perfectly into trait three, high switching costs and strong network effects, but redefined for the age of AI.
In the dot-com era, a network effect was simple. More users on Facebook made Facebook better for everyone. What's the moat look like when the base models are becoming commodities?
Defensibility today relies heavily on control over scarce resources. And the key scarce resource right now is proprietary data.
Okay.
If you have a unique, growing, hard-to-replicate data set that you use to fine-tune your model, you create this compounding advantage. Every user interaction makes your model better in a way no competitor can copy.
So the first-mover advantage, which kind of disappeared for a while, anyone could just copy your website, it's actually real again.
It's real again because data moats are incredibly sticky. The switching cost for your customer isn't just moving an account. It's moving away from a model that has been uniquely optimized for their needs.
A model that knows them? That's a huge shift. Okay, and finally, trait four, capital efficiency.
This is the big one. It's the difference between living through the boom and dying in the bust.
So simple, yet so hard.
Durable companies build margin discipline early. In a high interest rate world, relying on cheap capital is a recipe for absolute failure.
You can't assume the market will fund your losses forever.
The founders who survive are rigorously disciplined about their cost structure from day one. They are building a sustainable business that can withstand imperfect market conditions, which, let's be honest, are the norm, not the exception.
Before we wrap this up, there's one major global shift we have to talk about that makes this AI cycle so different.
Right. The initial internet boom was overwhelmingly a U.S. story. The source material points out that a country like Nigeria was only just getting internet access in 1998-1999.
Years after the dot-com mania was already in full swing here.
Exactly. Web3 shortened that gap quite a bit.
But AI just collapses it entirely.
It does. Talent, capital, projects, they're emerging globally from day one, not in sequence. We're seeing major breakthroughs happening simultaneously in the U.S., China, Europe, India.
It's a much more competitive landscape right from the start.
Absolutely.
But there's a huge constraint here that sort of re-regionalizes the power, and that's compute.
That is the choke point.
Talent might be evenly distributed around the globe, but specialized hardware, the GPUs, the massive data centers, is not.
Not at all. There are only a handful of major players in a few key geographies, principally the US and China, with some happening in Europe, that have the scale to build that foundational infrastructure.
And that disparity shapes where the biggest pools of capital end up.
And where the eventual infrastructure winners will reside, even if the groundbreaking talent is coming from everywhere.
So if we take a step back from all this,
The
debate over if AI is a bubble, It really is less important than focusing on these fundamentals.
Absolutely. The main perspective we found is don't waste time on the bubble debate. Cycles come and go. Real businesses, the ones with strong fundamentals, data advantages, commercial discipline, they fly during the boom.
And they gain irreversible market share during the bust.
Exactly. When their less disciplined competitors just wither away. For the durable players, it's a win-win scenario.
Oh, let's pull back from the balance sheets for our final thought. There's a question here that's, well, it's much bigger than finance. We're creating this world right now. And regardless of the financial cycle, the capabilities of AI are changing human existence at a speed we've never seen before.
And that raises the most profound question of all, one we rarely hear in the valuation debates. How are we, as a society, preparing for a world shaped by AI at this speed?
Because boom or burst, the technology isn't going away.
It's not retracting. We have to reckon with the world we are fundamentally creating right now.
A powerful thought. We'll leave you with this to consider. As you look at the AI landscape, which of those core infrastructure rails, the compute, the models, the proprietary data or the distribution? Which one do you believe will provide the strongest, most enduring defense in the decade to come? We'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.